Greetings and mucilaginous amphiblutions, my loverly listeners, and welcome to this October 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this stupendously trenchant science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Well, I think we've entered Indian summer here in the Northeast U.S., although I suppose you could blame global warming for the unusually high humidity and temperature at the moment. I will not side with either camp. I just want it to get cold here. I'm at my wit's end with sweating, and I would like a severe change in the weather. I suppose if you're a fan of Major League Baseball, then this is great weather for the playoffs, because it's a bit more comfortable in the stands and for the players. Although I'm sure non-U.S. listeners could care less, for the first time since 1992, the baseball playoffs will proceed without traditional East Coast powerhouses like the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox. And you know what? I think I'd better hold that thought before I turn this into the sports news update. Let's just get started with our first story of the night. Do tonsils do anything useful? Well, up until a few weeks back, the answer in almost any case would have been no. And it will still be no if you are more specific and ask, do they have any physiological function? However, Dr. Myeongmun Jung, who led a study at Ewha Women's University in South Korea, reports in the American Chemical Society journal, Applied Materials and Interfaces, this month, that there is something useful that tonsils can do. So what is this amazing thing? The paper describes a method for repairing damaged liver tissue without surgery by injecting patients with tonsil-derived mesenchymal stem cells. In the U.S. alone, nearly 17,000 people currently are waiting for liver transplants, but a shortage of donors, high surgical costs, and potential complications all remain fairly daunting realities of the procedure. Jung says, quote, there are hundreds of thousands of tonsillectomies carried out each year worldwide, and that tonsil tissue is just discarded. But it turns out that this discarded tissue can be a very good source of stem cells for hepatogenesis, unquote. Hepatogenesis is liver growth. While the abundance of tonsil tissues make tonsil stem cells ideal candidates for stem cell therapy, researchers have lacked a targeted delivery method for actually implanting those stem cells into the body. Jung points out, quote, some scientists have tried to directly inject the stem cells themselves, but if you inject the stem cells that way, then they'll just get washed away without any tissue growth. So we needed a 3D scaffold that acts like liver tissue to localize the cells into place at a targeted site, unquote. Jung's answer to this problem was to disperse the cells in an injectable liquid solution that actually forms a 3D gel when it reaches human body core temperature. The lab cultured the stem cells in a biodegradable polypeptide thermogel solution that contained growth factors that helped differentiate the stem cells into liver cells and to promote tissue development. When grown to 37 degrees in a culture system that mimics damaged tissue, the stem cells could be secured in the activated gel without raising toxicity or disrupting pH. The team monitored and analyzed these encapsulated liver cells in the transparent thermogel for a whole month. Jung says, quote, the ideal system is that the gel degradation time should be matched with the tissue growth time. So we wanted our thermogel to be displaced by the tissue developing from the cells after the stem cell application. Unquote. Now Jung's team is focused on optimizing their system for cell and drug delivery in animal models. With so many people needing liver transplants around the world, the ability to grow new livers would be amazing. I guess the only thing that would be more amazing would be if you could have a liver grown from your own tonsils. I'm wondering whether a new industry will grow up, like the one that stores umbilical cord blood from newborns. The new industry would store your tonsils frozen away until you might need its stem cells at the end of 50 years of hard drinking. Well, it's just a thought for you entrepreneurs out there. Perhaps you should present the idea on Shark Tank TV or something. Next story. Dr. Andrew Miller of Emory University reports in the September issue of the journal Cell that exercise is good for you. Wow, Dr. Miller, thanks. I always wondered about that. Okay, ignore my snarkiness. There was certainly more to the story than that. Really, Miller found a previously unknown link between muscles and the brain in mice. He says, quote, "Our work really emphasizes strong body, strong mind, and the finding also hints at new ways to treat brain disorders," unquote. It's been known for a while that in response to a good workout, muscles produce a compound called PGC1-alpha-1, which is a kind of general do-gooder around the body. For instance, the compound prompts the body to make more blood vessels and more mitochondria. The new study, which includes tests involving a small number of people, shows that PGC1-alpha-1's rejuvenating effects actually even extend to the brain. In Miller's work, mice were exposed to 5 weeks of unpredictable stressors, such as food deprivation, strobe lights, and loud noises, which to me sounds like your average college dorm. Anyway, at the end of their ordeal, mice showed signs of stress-induced depression, such as not drinking as much sweet water and giving up in a tank of water instead of struggling to swim. Again, this sounds a lot like college students, too, at about the middle of the semester. At any rate, as you would expect, the mouse brains also showed signs of depression, and key genes changed their expression behavior in response to the stress. Miller also did the same experiment with another bunch of mice who were genetically tweaked to produce more PGC1-alpha-1 in their skeletal muscles than normally seen. At the end of 5 weeks, the overproducers seemed immune to the chronic stress and actually showed fewer signs of depressions. Miller states, quote, "Nothing happened. The brain was completely protected," unquote. When produced after exercise, PGC1 kicks off a chain of chemical events in muscles that culminates in neutralizing a stress-induced toxin called kynurenine. If you inject kynurenine into a mouse, that mouse will show signs of depression. And any mouse injected with kynurenine that wasn't exposed to any stressors will still show signs of depression. Miller states that, quote, "kynurenine may be a much more malignant molecule than we had previously appreciated," unquote. However, PGC1-alpha-1 is important because its production in the muscle leads to the conversion of kynurenine into a form that can't pass into the brain. The results show how muscle can have a profound effect on other organs. It almost acts like a detoxifying organ, like the liver or the kidneys. Mice that ran on an exercise wheel covering more than 4 kilometers a night for 8 weeks also experienced benefits, the team found. And there were hints that people could achieve the same protection via a heavy workout. After 3 weeks of exercise, volunteers' muscles produced more kynurenine-neutralizing molecules than you would find in people who hadn't been working out. To get the benefits, anyone would need to routinely challenge their muscles, and that means regularly upping their exercise regimes. And we are talking heavy, regular exercise. Miller says, quote, "An easy daily walk probably wouldn't be rigorous enough to boost PGC1-alpha-1 production," unquote. A subset of people with depression might benefit strongly from exercise therapy or from drugs developed to target kynurenine or the molecules that interact with it. Again, Miller says, quote, "The benefits of PGC1-alpha-1 probably wouldn't stop at depression. People with cancer, autoimmune disorders, or other diseases that involve inflammation might benefit from stronger muscles. All of these are going to be associated with high levels of kynurenine, and we now know that we can begin to possibly clear out the system by encouraging patients to exercise," unquote. Well, seriously, may I add college students to the list of the stressed and depressed who might benefit from heavy exercise? I know I was joking earlier about dorm and college life, but even in silliness, there is a kernel of truth that can be garnered. Next story. This is a story I got out of the journal Scientist, and it shows that not all countries treat science or scientists in quite the same way. 3 years ago, Diego Gomez, a conservation biology student at the University of Quindío in Colombia, posted another scientist graduate thesis online. He found the thesis already online, and he reposted it because he thought it would be interesting for other groups. So he shared it on the web. Gomez says, quote, "When uploading the thesis, I never thought I was violating any law. I was respecting the authorship of who made the thesis. I thought it was in the public domain because it was already on the internet, and the only thing I tried was to get it to a research group, and such documents are publicly available. This type of literature is not of commercial interest, so I never thought I could do any damage to the author. On the contrary, I thought that I was giving him benefits on sharing his work," unquote. But the author of the thesis disagreed, and last year complained to the Colombian police about the posting. Gomez now faces up to 8 years in jail and at least $6,000 in fine for violating copyright laws. His case highlights the plight of scientists in certain parts of the world who are less able to access and share scientific information. To put it simply, the criminal case would not have gone anywhere in a U.S. court at all. This is because of the big difference between American, and I believe the European Union law as well, and Colombian law. The biggest difference between Colombian and U.S. law is that in Colombia, copyright infringement is a criminal act. In the U.S., the owner of the material would bring a civil suit instead. In a situation like that, Gomez likely would have been ordered to remove the post, which he did before the criminal complaint was filed, and perhaps pay author damages. But nothing more. Carolina Botera, an attorney at Fundación Carisma, who has been advocating on behalf of Gomez, has assigned a different lawyer to represent the student. According to Botera, the prosecution presented enough evidence at a hearing last December that the judge decided to proceed with the trial. She said that the complaint from the author of the thesis is that he was not able to publish papers based on the research because Gomez distributed his results. Colombian media have named a local herpetologist as the complainant, but it is not being made public. Botero told the scientist that she's baffled why Gomez was singled out when sharing scientific material, particularly the primary literature, is commonplace. Researchers who have limited access to libraries, online databases, and journals in places like Colombia often rely on one another to find relevant material. Botero stated to the scientist, quote, "If everybody was suing because of this, it would be a huge problem in Colombia because it is so common," unquote. Some Latin American countries have made efforts to broaden accessibility to published research. Argentina, for example, last year passed a law requiring publicly funded research to be published in open access format. Gomez says, quote, "Today, what the vast majority of the country's researchers and conservationists are doing, despite being committed to spreading knowledge, is turning us into criminals," unquote. Gomez's next hearing is actually occurring right now, this October, when a judge will decide his case. Next story. I'm really getting to the point where I am beginning to wonder if those people who are on the so-called Neolithic diet have the right idea. Just eat the foods that our ancient ancestors ate, the foods that we evolved with, and maybe, just maybe, you'll be a bit healthier. The latest food fiasco is related to artificial sweeteners, which apparently are pretty harmless by themselves, but have now been shown to be not only useless, but even harmful in the long term in controlling weight, if overindulged in. A new multi-pronged study of mice, and as well as a small number of people, finds that saccharin messes up the gut's microbial community. That's an official scientific word or phrase, messes up. And what it will do is it will set in motion metabolic changes that are associated with obesity and diabetes. Other zero-calorie sweeteners may cause the same problems, say researchers from the September 17th issue of Nature. Though the finding is preliminary, 4 of 7 human volunteers eating a diet high in saccharin developed impaired glucose metabolism, which is a warning sign for type 2 diabetes. Until recently, most sugar substitutes were thought to pass through the gut undigested, exerting little to no effect on the intestinal cells. As ingredients in diet soda, sugar-free desserts, and a whole range of other foods, the sweeteners have always been touted as a way for people with diabetes and weight problems to enjoy a varied diet. But the new study, led by Drs. Aaron Siegel and Aaron Elenaf of the Weizmann Institute of Science, suggests that rather than helping people, the sweeteners may just promote problems. After 11 weeks of drinking saccharin water, or sucralose, or aspartame, mice had abnormally high glucose levels in their blood after eating. When glucose metabolism is impaired, high glucose levels, again, the hallmark of diabetes, can result. Since blood glucose levels were most off-kilter in the saccharin-fed mice, the researchers zeroed in on this sweetener, which is the one that's found in Sweet and Low. Yes, those little pink packets that we love so much. The scientists gave saccharin to mice that were fed a high-fat diet. The mice developed impaired glucose metabolism in as little as 5 weeks, suggesting that the sweetener had the same effect regardless of whether mice were lean or overweight. Meanwhile, mice eating glucose-laced water had normal metabolism. Then the scientists gave the saccharin-fed mice antibiotics to wipe out their intestinal bacteria. The mice's glucose metabolism actually recovered after that, suggesting that the gut microbes might play a role in glucose metabolism, and an important one at that. So, get ready to be uncomfortable. The researchers then transplanted fecal microbes from the saccharin-fed mice into the guts of mice with microbe-free intestines that then in turn developed impaired glucose metabolism. Genetic analyses of the microbes in the mice's intestines revealed major differences in the microbial groups presented in saccharin-fed mice compared with mice eating just a regular diet. Why? Why is this happening? Well, your guess is as good as the researchers. Apparently, there's a whole panoply of explanations. Well, maybe some bacteria thrive on saccharin and then just outcompete their neighbors. Maybe the sweetener kills off other bacteria. Perhaps the saccharin exposure makes the gut microbes make toxins of some kind that affect glucose homeostasis. Maybe the sweetener causes the good bacteria to teleport out. That one is less likely. The mechanisms that disrupt glucose metabolism also, really, they remain mysterious. But it's clear that saccharin doesn't just pass silently through the mouse intestine with no effect. It also doesn't pass through people silently either. Whoopee. I thought this might just be a mouse thing. When the researchers looked at 40 people who reported eating artificial sweeteners and compared them to 236 who did not, the sweetener eaters were more likely to have had metabolic problems, including, yes, impaired glucose metabolism. And when 7 healthy volunteers ate the Food and Drug Administration's maximum acceptable daily dose of saccharin for a week, 4 of them developed off-kilter glucose metabolisms. Transferring feces from 2 of these 4 people into mice, ew again, induced the same problems in the rodents, suggesting that gut microbes were to blame. The authors state that, quote, "Our results are consistent with a bigger picture, suggesting that some amenities of the relatively microbe-free modern Western society, such as heavy antibiotic use and cesarean sections, may actually promote disease. We have to respect the power of the microbiota. We need to step back and see what we are doing." Unquote. I just find this so ironic that we banned saccharin for years, decades, because we thought it caused cancer. Then we brought saccharin back after those decades, and it still had a health warning. Then the health warning was removed. Now, we are probably going to put the health warning back. Perhaps we were just better off when it was banned. For the last story of the night, I will return to our titillating feature of the month. We haven't done a good story on reproduction in several months. So what is this one about? Well, it has to do with reproduction in the nematode worm Xenorhabditis elegans. If a male C. elegans mates with a nematode which is not of his species, it will turn into quite the horror show for the female of the opposite species. This discussion may get a bit hot and heavy for kitties, if you know what I mean, so Be warned. Okay. Dr. Eric Haig of the University of Maryland has reported in the journal PLOS Biology at the end of July that the sperm of certain species of worms can be more aggressive if it finds itself in the wrong species. The sperm of these male worms can be so aggressive, in fact, that they can reduce the fertility of, or eventually even kill, the receiving partner. The marauding sperm push beyond normal receptacles for sperm and then storm into the ovaries and the rest of the partner's reproductive tract. Haig says, quote, "Premature contact with sperm can ruin eggs that have not developed enough for fertilization. Then, aggressive sperm can burst out of the ovary and start crawling around in the body cavity," unquote. Haig says he's even found sperm barging around in a partner's head. Biologist or not, all I can say to that is, ew. Even though it is seriously gruesome, such mating mayhem gives clues to which worm species have long-standing conflicts between the sexes, or would be hard to detect otherwise. And Haig doesn't think it's any more pleasant than I do. He says, quote, "The cross-species mating results are kind of gross. It's a weird thing, but at the same time, it's telling us that within a species, the world is much rougher than it looks," unquote. The contrasts between the nematode species' mating habits lie at the heart of Haig's experiment. You see, C. elegans are not just male and female, with the expected transfer of genetic information as such. In Xenorhabditis elegans, and several other related species, male worms are actually pretty rare. Most individuals are self-fertilizing hermaphrodites. That's a majority. Nematode gonads do not form elaborate, specialized structures. So it's not a big deal for individuals to start out life producing and storing sperm, and then later to switch to making eggs for the stored sperm to actually fertilize. These minimalist hermaphrodites don't have the right anatomy to deliver sperm to another worm, but they can receive sperm from the occasional males of their species. Haig says, quote, "They go generations without mating at all. The only problem is that when you mate with yourself repeatedly, eventually over evolutionary time, the sperm of these species become weak competitors," unquote. There are other species of Xenorhabditis that do have full-time male and females, and they often mate with multiple partners in worm orgies. In such a promiscuous worming arena, evolution favors barnstorming aggression that lets sperm reach an egg first. Haig states that, quote, "For females of these species, their body is the battleground upon which these males are fighting," unquote. Evolution favors females that make sure the pushy, aggressive sperm that are good at fertilizing eggs don't get too pushy and harm them. As long as the two sexes counterbalance each other, the escalating conflict between the sexes causes little visible harm and can be difficult for a scientist to detect. Signs of the hidden evolutionary arms race reveal themselves when worm species get mixed up. The ferocious aggression showed up when researchers paired males from various competitive species with partners from any of three self-fertilizing hermaphrodite species, including C. elegans. The competitive alien species sperm not only goes on rampages, but can actually push aside the smaller sperm from males of the mostly hermaphroditic species. Nematode sperm can't swim, but are powerful amoeba-like crawlers. In one set of doom pairings, a population of the mild-mannered C. brigsiae hermaphrodites started dying after only one encounter with males of the C. nagoni species. These pairings also yielded only about 25 young on average, instead of the 225 or more from hermaphrodites left to fertilize themselves. Wow, I guess Pat Benatar was right. Love is a battlefield. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Always stick to mating within your own species, for safety's sake. Watch that saccharin intake, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.